everybody. Welcome to Sweater Weather, a podcast about Canadian arts and culture. I'm Aaron Giovannone, a writer and professor.
And I'm Naomi Lewis, a writer and an editor.
How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. And yourself?
I'm good. Mm-hmm. I'm good. It's Christmas time.
Yeah.
It's the holiday season.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
So I'm wearing this is actually a shirt that I wear only during the holidays.
That's right. Because your Christmas shirt.
It's kind of obnoxious to wear red and green of this sort.
I think you could wear it any time. But.
Okay. Also lit the studio with red and green as well. That was the color choices.
Nicely done.
Yeah.
So. I knew I felt festive, but I couldn't put my finger on why.
How's the holiday season going for you so far?
Well, it's a lot of socializing, which is kind of a shock to the system, but a good one.
It's nice. Mm-hmm. It's nice to finally see people again.
It is.
To go out and do stuff.
It is.
Having parties.
Lots of dinners and lunches.
Dinners. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
So we want to let everyone out there know, if you like Sweater Weather, it'd be really nice if you support us with... Well, there's a lot of ways you can support us on social media, wherever you see us, a like or a share.
A review.
A review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
That all really helps other people see us and hear us. So
find us.
If you really like us, we'd appreciate your support at patreon.com/Canadian Sweater. And you can make a monthly donation there. And patrons of the show currently get some perks. They get early access to new episodes. They get them before everybody else. And there's a few other things there. We are going to be, in the new year, it's maybe one of our New Year's resolutions, is to start building our Patreon community.
That's right.
That's right. And offering
special
patron-only episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is, I guess, a little bit of a tease for what will be coming in the new year. At some point.
That's right.
That's right. But
the new year being 2023.
Oh, that's right. Who knows when people are watching this?
I know. It could be like 10 years from now.
That's right. I hope. I hope we really last that long in public consciousness.
We will, Aaron. We will. Especially this episode.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, this is a holiday episode. And like the holiday episodes are the ones that people watch again and again.
That's right. Like last night we watched...
What did we watch?
A Muppet Family Christmas from 1987.
Yeah, that's right. There's a good version on YouTube.
And it hasn't gotten old at all. But we're not making this podcast about the Muppet Christmas.
This is not a Muppets Family Christmas podcast.
No.
This is, well, I'm not going to introduce the topic of our show quite yet. Not before we introduce our guest. Our guest today is Maxime Raymond Bach. So Maxime has published 5 books of fiction in French, his latest being the novel Morel, which appeared in 2021. 2 of his books have been translated into English. These are Atavisms from 2015 and Baloney from 2016. So Max has a PhD and is currently a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Alberta. And he's joining us from Montreal, where he lives. Hi, Max.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for being here with us.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
You and Naomi did meet, right? I didn't meet you in person when we were in Montreal, but you and Naomi hung out?
Yeah,
we met at the library.
At the library. We had coffee and talked about your visit to the doctor.
That's right.
Unfortunately.
Max's partner, Melissa Bull, is my friend, and she was the person who I was with when I injured my finger in Montreal. I was out for a drink with her when... the bathroom door of a bar slammed on my hand, and Melissa, who I met for the first time that day in person, took me to the hospital, talked to the doctors in French for me.
That's nice.
Yeah, it was amazing. And then we had to be friends because we were trauma bonded.
Yeah. Well, you will remember your visit to Montreal forever.
Yeah, I will.
Whenever you see your little injury on your finger, you will remember Montreal.
Yeah, it's true. But it was worth it to become friends with Melissa. Although maybe I could have been friends with her without that happening.
Sounds like the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Indeed, it was.
Yeah. Yes. A bond forged in fire.
That's right.
That's right.
In blood.
In blood. Fire and blood. So today, so excited to have Maxime here with us to talk about our topic. our topic is. Naomi, you ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
It's the sweater. The sweater.
Sweater weather?
No.
No, just the sweater.
Don't muddy the waters.
Here. I always thought it was called the hockey sweater.
Yeah, so the animated film version of the story is called The Sweater.
Mm-hmm.
And the story version, book form, is called The Hockey Sweater. Okay. So we'll probably use those two interchangeably. And actually, The Hockey Sweater seems like a better title to me.
And what's the title in French in the original?
Well, that's going to
The original.
Yeah.
From 1979.
Yeah.
Was not Le Chandail. It was L'Abominable Feuille d'Érable sur la Glace.
Oh.
The Abominable Maple Leaf on the Ice.
Okay.
So this is a very interesting transformation that happened between the two versions with the translation. That's something we could talk about because that's really interesting comparing the two versions.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I probably will call it the hockey sweater, although we are talking about the film probably a lot, and that's called The Sweater. So,
all right.
So The Sweater is from 1980. It's an animated short film written and narrated by Roch Carrier, and it's based on his 1978. I mean, it was published in 79, but it was performed, I think, for the first time in 78, called The Hockey Sweater. So,
in English.
In English, yeah. So it has had different versions over the years. In French, currently... What is the story called? It's called Le Chandail in French?
Le Chandail.
Le Chandail.
Yeah.
Okay. So the same as the film in French.
Okay.
Currently.
Right.
Okay.
But there are subtitles. The second title in French is different from the English subtitle, second title also in the movie. That's really interesting.
Okay.
They skip the abominable again in the movie.
Okay.
Because the French title is Le Chandail, un abominable souvenir.
Oh,
an abominable reminiscence.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
wow.
In the English, it's just a childhood recollection.
That's right.
That's really interesting how they toned it down.
Yeah.
For the English audience.
Yeah.
Really interesting. Yeah, those who might have other loyalties, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, I mean, they were very careful to make sure the story appealed to, like, the two solitudes.
Mm-hmm.
And they had slightly different versions for both. It is interesting. So the sweater film is animated by Sheldon Cohen, a Montreal animator, director, graphic artist. Now, the sweater tells the story of a young Roch Carrier who, at 10 years old, lives in his small village of Sainte-Justine. And he's a diehard fan of the great Maurice Richard, star player for his adored Montreal Canadiens.
The Rocket, right?
The Rocket. So the film and story is set in 1946, the year before Maurice Richard had scored 50 goals in a season, which was the first time any player had done that.
Oh.
So after a mix-up, ordering from the Eaton's catalog, Carrier is forced to wear the jersey of the hated rival team, the Maple Leafs.
The abominable Maple Leafs.
That's right. And so...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so the story ensues from there.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to say something, Max. I think I cut you off.
No, I was just reacting to the abominable Maple Leafs.
Yeah. The Leafs suck. Even their fans will say that the Leafs suck.
Yeah.
So the hockey sweater was published as a standalone children's book with Sheldon Cohen's illustrations as well. That book has gone on to sell over 300,000 copies.
In English and French? Just
Yeah, I'm not sure, but actually, yeah, good question, actually. I'm not sure about that. If you look at the film on YouTube, I mean, the English version has like over 1 million views, but that's just on YouTube. It has many more millions of views than that, for sure.
Yeah, a million sounds small.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So that's just a little bit of background on the sweater or the hockey sweater. Do we have opening thoughts about the hockey sweater or Roch Carrier? For like, you know, original, I don't know. Were you familiar with this at all before, Naomi?
I was familiar with it, like, vaguely. I feel like I must have read it or seen the film at some point in school, especially in French immersion. I went to French immersion as a kid in Ottawa.
Yeah.
And I mean, I couldn't remember it, but then when I saw it and read it again recently for the podcast, I knew the story. So obviously it was already in my head. And like, I knew that for some reason that was the only, like, Maurice Richard was the only hockey player I'd ever heard of in my life. And I'm pretty sure it's because of that book.
Because of that book.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Max, how about you? What are your like first earliest memories of this story or of this author?
Well, I think that when you have just a little bit of cultural and historical knowledge or understanding, you know about that story. It's part of the culture. And I think I remember seeing the movie when I was younger, probably during Christmas time on TV. And it's just something that you know about. And, you know, I've noticed it was on the $5 bills.
That's
of
right.
Of course.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There's an excerpt of the story. And but reading it for the first time, word for word, for our podcast, for our discussion, that was really interesting because, you know, when stories like that are a part of the culture and you know about them without even having read them.
Yeah.
Or having
you
to
don't
think
see
about
the whole picture. You don't see all the details, and reading it and comparing the two versions in French and English and seeing both versions of the animated film, that was really an interesting. How can I say it? We're academics. We're writers. We criticize every little detail we find. We interpret everything and try to see things with a wider stance and a wider understanding of things. And there's really much more to this little story there. It's really interesting. And it made me read again another novel from Roque Carrier, La Guerre, Yes, Sir.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you heard about that one. This is really a really heavier book than just a little children's story. But it deals with the same antagonisms, and there's a hockey scene in that book too, which is very different and very violent. So it's really interesting everything that's going on with Roque Carrier's translated in English by Sheila Fishman, I think.
That's right. Yeah.
For ANC in the 90s. So you can look it up in English too. A very different tone, violence. Mm.
It is.
Draft Dodgers.
I dipped into that book in preparation for today as well. It's a book for, I believe it's from, it was published in 1972, so it's
68.
So it's earlier than the hockey sweater,
And it's not for children.
It is definitely not for children. Okay. It opens with a scene. Opens with a scene, if I remember correctly, of a man cutting his hand off so that he doesn't have to be drafted to go to the war.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So it's a very violent.
And just after that, kids are playing hockey with the severed hand.
That's right.
They don't have
my gosh, yes.
They don't have a hockey puck. They play with the severed hand.
Oh, my goodness.
Yikes. It
so
is,
that
yeah.
wouldn't
for
go
children.
On the $5. That's for the $20
bill. That's right. That's for like the $500 bill. Only rich people could handle it.
Interesting change in tone from Carrier's writing over the years. Yeah. Maybe we'll have more of a chance to dip into some of the themes, the shared themes between the hockey sweater and La Guerre. Yes, sir. Now, when we were thinking of doing an episode for December, for the holidays, I did think of this story immediately, and I have really associated it with Christmas time.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the gift of the hockey sweater, I think I misremembered it as being a Christmas gift.
So did I, yeah.
Yeah, so that's how much I associated it with Christmas time. Now, I think another reason I associate it with Christmas time is because in elementary school, probably from grades like 3 to grade 8, St. Anne's Catholic School in Fenwick, Ontario, little village in the Niagara region of Ontario, they showed us this film like every year in school. Probably the last day before the Christmas break when the teachers don't want to teach anything and the students don't want to learn anything and they wheel out the television. And so they would show us kid-friendly films. And this would always be on the playlist for that last day of school before Christmas. And so I think probably a teacher had questions for us after, trying to make it an appropriate school lesson of some sort. I don't remember what questions we were being asked. I wish I did. Mm-hmm. I wish I actually did remember what questions the teacher was asking us about this film. Now, I had no connection at all to like hockey. My father is an Italian immigrant, did not play hockey, did not care about hockey. My mom's family, not athletic, not sports fans. So, like, there was no hockey in our house, no hockey culture really at all. I would watch Hockey Night in Canada, Saturday nights, kind of like, I guess, the way that little Roch Carrier listens to it on the radio in the story. But it's because we only had, five or eight television stations. So I was watching hockey because it was one of the only good things on. I wasn't a huge fan of hockey. I mean, I couldn't skate.
Okay.
I didn't own proper skates. Actually, many people in our school, they were like, a lot of them, they were like immigrant, kids of immigrants, you know, like Greeks and Poles. Like, they didn't play hockey either.
Yeah.
And I remember when our school would take us on like a yearly, maybe twice a year trip to the arena for an afternoon skating. Like, I hated that.
Me too.
Because I had these, my mom like got me, again, because it was like zero investment in skating or hockey, my mom got me some used skates that were like really, they were like leather from the 1970s. Could not lace them properly.
Oh,
they were
no.
super floppy on my ankles. Toes freezing. I found this annoying because I otherwise enjoyed sports. Like, I was like, we played a lot of soccer at school, and I was the best soccer player at school. So that's a brag about being good at soccer in elementary school. But like, I think like this story had a big part in me. Again, I'm not a hockey. I didn't know much about hockey. There was no hockey culture in my house. I just decided that the Montreal Canadiens were going to be my favorite team.
Okay.
And that was because of this, partly because of the story.
Yeah.
These were also the years of the legendary goaltender, you know, Patrick Waugh. And they won, you know, the Canadiens won a Stanley Cup in 92, 93, right? So they were like, around that age, that was like a cool team to like because they were good.
Yeah. Well, actually, the first Cup Waugh won was in 86.
Okay.
And he won it again in 93. That
was
the last cup, Montreal Canadiens Cup.
Yeah, that's the last time they won a cup, right? But in Niagara, like, because we are, like, close geographically to Toronto and culturally, obviously, too. But, like, you didn't have to like the Leafs. Like, it was acceptable to like the Sabres, the Buffalo Sabres, because they were actually closer. And I've only, the only hockey game I've actually attended, I've never attended a Maple Leafs game in Toronto. I've seen them a few times in Buffalo where the tickets were like one-third the price, basically. So you could always get in to see a hockey game in Buffalo. In Toronto, you can't get in because it's super expensive and in really high demand. So, but the Canadiens, I think a big reason I like the Canadiens, and if you ask me what's my favorite team now, I'd probably still just, I'm not, like, I don't follow hockey that closely, but I would probably say, oh, the Canadiens are cool. Partly because of the jersey. Is nice. It's a cool color. It's a nice color scheme.
Yeah.
Again, like, it's probably related to this movie that I did really like. I always looked forward
to
it.
They did, like, indoctrinate you.
They successfully created a Montreal Canadiens fan.
Excellent.
Out of, like, the moldable clay that was the child of an immigrant.
Yeah.
Like, Max, like, do you play hockey? I mean, you like hockey, you mentioned. Have you played hockey too?
Yes. I always loved hockey. Being a Montrealer, the Habs, you know, they're the biggest team. They won so many cups. I was 12 when they won the last one.
Yeah.
And I remember dancing in the house when they won.
Oh,
I
just
always
like
loved
in the movie.
The Habs. Yeah. And I played when I was like 5 or 6, but I wasn't a good skater. I wasn't a good player. And not being the son of the coach, because that's how it works. they told me, okay, you'll be a defense. And I wasn't a good skater. So I just waited for the puck there. And when the puck came to me, I would shove it back all the way down the ice.
Nice.
I never scored a goal. I wasn't a good player. And so that was my hockey career, maybe 10 games.
Oh, really? Okay. It
my
was
mother did. Yeah, my mother didn't like my attitude towards playing hockey because she said, I don't really remember it, but she said it made me really aggressive and I wanted to play and I wanted to be good and I wanted to be competitive.
Wow.
But I wasn't able to because I didn't have the talent and, you know, at the time of the story, hockey was for the poor people. Mm. You played with whatever you could find, like a severed hand. If there happened to be one
frozen
close to you.
Frozen horse turd.
Yeah, frozen. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. But and, you know, nowadays, you need to have money to play
That's
hockey.
Right.
It's expensive.
It is expensive.
And, you know, we didn't have any of this, so yeah. That was my career. Maybe 10 games, defenseman,
well,
waiting for the puck.
It turned out you were good at something else.
I always loved sport mm-hmm. as a fan, mm-hmm. looking at sports, but also playing for fun.
Oh, nice.
So I can relate to, I mean... There's not many works of fiction that depict good sports, mm-hmm. and well, in literature, in Quebec literature, is something that we miss. Mm. Good writing on about sports.
Okay. Yeah.
So
I don't really know. I that's a good point. I can't think of a lot.
There are quite a few, like a few Canadian novels at least that involve hockey that I can think of. Like Indian Horse, isn't that?
Oh, yeah,
like
Indian
Richard
Horse.
Richard Wagamese?
Yeah, Indian Horse by Richard Wagamese, and maybe in other of his works. He describes hockey quite well. He's very mm-hmm. good at writing about physical descriptions, like movement. He's very good at writing that, mm-hmm. yeah. So
have you read that?
Yeah, but from an interior point mm-hmm. of view,
yeah.
from a player
right.
narrating how you play, how you feel about the sport, what's the camaraderie with your fellow players,
yeah.
being in a competitive, you know, the interior point of view
yeah.
lacks in literature, I think.
Mm. Yeah.
For hockey, but for many other sports,
mm-hmm. yeah.
it's not a topic we read a lot about.
Interesting.
That's a good point, yeah. Mm-hmm. Should we jump into the background mm-hmm. about Roch Carrier? Okay, so here we go. So Roch Carrier was born in 1937 in the village of Sainte-Justine, Quebec. It's population of 1,200 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's about 120 kilometers south of Quebec City. And it's not far from the U.S. border with Maine, but it's quite remote, especially in 1937. So Roch was the second of seven children. His father was a traveling salesman. He sold farm products, tools, fertilizer, lumber, stuff like that. His mother was a school teacher. Now, one of Carrier's grandfathers had been a blacksmith. Another was a lumberjack and farmer. And so you can actually see Carrier's farmer grandfather in a 1972 documentary, also for the NFB. It's called The Ungrateful Land. Roch Carrier remembers Sainte-Justine. And it's really neat. It's from the 70s. And you see Carrier returns to the village. He interviews people there. You don't actually get a lot of his family. His mm-hmm. grandfather's there a little bit. But he's mostly talking to others in the village. And his thesis really is like how difficult and how isolated village life is, especially for those who have business or cultural ambitions mm-hmm. in the wider world. And so Carrier in this documentary says of Sainte-Justine, quote, "The village is a metaphor for all of Quebec." I don't know. What do you think of that? The village is a metaphor for all of Quebec. Is that something that makes sense to you, Max?
I can understand it, especially when you talk about how the traditional way of living. He was a lumberjack, you said?
His grandfather was
grandfather.
A farmer and a lumberjack, yeah. Other grandfather was a
yeah.
blacksmith.
So these were fields of work that were declining at that moment in the 70s.
Yeah.
So all the traditional knowledge was disappearing with this old generation.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see that at that moment, these people who were living in the same way since generations
yeah.
didn't have anything, didn't see anything in the future. So yeah. they cannot make their knowledge go down in history mm-hmm. with their sons and great sons and all because you don't chop wood anymore in that region or you don't
yeah.
make goods like you did in artisanat.
Yeah, artisanal. Yeah.
A traditional way. So there's a difference between the traditional Quebec that we can see in the sweater story.
Yeah.
And the more modern Quebec that appeared at the Quiet Revolution that changed deeply the society
yeah.
with public health, public education,
yeah.
nationalization of electricity, yeah. that brought wealth into the state to invest for everyone. That it's like we went from tradition to postmodernity in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. So the society changed a lot.
Yeah.
And I think in the 70s, at that moment, Carrier was already in his 40s. He was a well-established writer, and he had succeeded in an intellectual and artistic field that wasn't easy to get in at that moment when he was younger. But still, he became an adult and succeeded when the baby boomers were adults.
Yes.
At the turning of the 60s. Yeah. So there was a critical mass of people, people with ideals, a lot of energy. They were looking forward. They were looking for the future. They were investing themselves in all society. So I think what he says by that is that he's seeing that the traditional ways of life are disappearing.
Yeah.
And not whole Quebec is ready for that modernity that's appearing at that moment in the 70s.
That's right.
Might still be true a little bit today in some regions, but you know, we went, some say that we jumped from the Middle Ages to postmodern times.
Oh, that's so interesting.
In one generation.
Yeah, thank
yeah.
you
in
for
Quebec.
That context. Yeah.
Yeah, actually Carrier says something similar. Mm. He talks about a move. He describes peasant life as from the Middle Ages, farming life of that era.
But at the same time, it's also cliche and prejudice because what I see in literature when I read it, Quebec literature and all, and when I look at, you know, every cultural aspect I can put my hands on, I always find that Quebec is more modern than we say it is at any time.
Yeah. Oh, is that right?
And it's a question. Yeah, yeah. And it's a question of censorship. We don't see the most interesting and the most modern works of art because censorship at the time put the lid on them, and we have to look back to see that we were way more modern than we always thought we were.
Right.
So interesting.
So Carrier's, his nuclear family, however, they were middle class in the context of the village. So they, you know, for example, they had a maid at the house.
Oh.
Rock was a good student. He was drawn to literature and theater. At the age of eight, he was writing plays, apparently, writing little plays for himself. So he was an altar boy and sincerely pious. And because of his predilection for school and church, his family planned for him to become a priest. Obviously, Rock enjoyed playing hockey, as we see in the hockey sweater. But Carrier said this of his hockey playing ability in a later interview, quote, "I was a very bad player. In fact, I was the worst player on the team. I was perhaps the one who tried harder than anyone else, and I kept trying, but I was the worst player."
Sound familiar?
And so a few...
Yeah, it sounds like me. You quit hockey and you start writing.
That's right.
That's what you do.
You can't be good at both.
So more from Carrier. In those days, there weren't three hockey games every night on television. There was no television. There was almost nothing. So the hockey game on Saturday, it was something as big as the news from the war. It was bigger. So, of course, we're talking about the 1940s during the war, Second World War.
Yeah.
Carrier attended primary school in the village, and then he went to a seminary nearby in Saint-Georges-de-Beauce. Rock hated the seminary. He said he found it, quote, morose and stifling. But he did enjoy literary activities there. He was the editor of the school paper. In 1954, when he was 17, Carrier was expelled from the seminary for having in his possession banned books. So these included titles by Zola, Proust, Balzac, and Éluard.
Balzac. Yeah, English speakers always say Balzac.
I never thought of it that way.
Anyway, he got kicked
very
out.
Very rebellious, indeed.
He got kicked out of school for reading this.
Reading Proust is like not what I would normally think of as something to get kicked out of school for.
I know, right? I mean, they keep trying to get you to read this in school.
Yeah.
I suppose there were, I mean,
naughty bits?
There were naughty bits, probably descriptions of sex and other licentious activities, mm-hmm. I imagine.
Yeah, well, I was talking about censorship just earlier, and that's one thing that was really controlled by the Catholic Church, yeah. Reading from the depictions of the city was a problem.
Oh.
Because modernity is associated with the city. That's where you have people from all around the world. The more liberal thoughts, ideals, politics come from the city, and so everything that was not talking about, because at that moment when he was young, so it was in the 40s, the 50s, education was still controlled by the church in Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
So reading anything about books was controlled very strictly. And we had this index, we call, the list of books that were banned, and that you had to ask to read.
Oh, wow.
So of course the religious people had these books, they read these books, they knew all about it because they had to control the different ideologies that were circulating among their students. So they had the books and they could lend them if you asked them.
Okay.
But, you know, they would know who had what book. So it's kind of a mind control thing that still happened until the Quiet Revolution. So reading the great French realists like Zola, Balzac, and Flaubert, and all these people that were in their time, they went to court. Mm-hmm. People tried to sue them, to censor mm-hmm. them in France at that moment. They were bringing modern ideologies in Quebec, which was not appreciated by the powers that be.
Yeah.
But his generation, Carrier's generation, did the Révolution Tranquille, the Quiet Revolution, because they read, even if they mm-hmm. didn't have the right to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So at that time, was there a lot of, like, enough literature produced in Quebec that you could just not read books from France? Or was it, I mean, the way that in English Canada, the canon was like all books from England until very mm-hmm. recently. Is that similar?
There's this, I was talking about the difference between the cliches and the prejudice and the mm-hmm. reality. When we look back at Quebec, we always find out that it was more open and modern than we think. And all these books were in Quebec, they were circulating, they were read, but it was done in hiding.
Mm.
You know, it was prohibited, but everybody who wanted to read could find a book. France has always been such a great writing literature nation, and of course in Quebec we've always looked back to France as a mm-hmm. model to try to emulate, and we always wish to be recognized in France for what we are and not, you know, being just an exotic old mm-hmm. colony that's writing with a word not proper French or weird words or whatever. And these books were accessible. If you wanted them, you could find them. And the literary creation here might have been a little harder to write modern novels, modern ideas. These books were, if they were not censored right away in church by the clergyman, who would say, "Do not read these books, you'll go to hell." they would be voluntarily criticized negatively in mm-hmm. the press.
Yeah.
So they would not have a nice public life. So there's always been this battle between modernity and tradition. And at that moment, modernity was gaining ground. So it was the end of censorship, the official censorship at that moment until the 60s.
So you couldn't get these books in the library, in the public library?
Some libraries. There was one famous library in Montreal. The was held by Henri Tranquille, was his name. So he was famous for bringing in all these books from around the world, contemporary literature, modern literature. And he he did what he had to do. He survived the censorship as he was the center for all cultural activities in Montreal, not just for writing, but also the visual artists, the drama writers and all. So
that was a private library. Yeah. Okay.
But he was very active in all cultural activities. And, you know, Quebec being a big and complex society, you have all kinds of ideologies. You have the whole spectrum of all ideas in the cultural realm, in the political realm, and whatever. And was the case at that moment. So there were modern artists in the 40s. Refus Global, you might look into it. That was a manifest by a visual artist. Yeah. Paul-Émile Bourdieu was a painter, very important painter. So they published a manifest in 48, which is called Refus Global. Global, we refuse everything. Nationalism, the church, everything. Let's be more modern. Let's write, they were called the automatists, the automatists. Let's write and paint on the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like Pollock did, or like the surrealists did. So there's always this fight between modernity and tradition in Quebec, and most often the most interesting works are with this modern writing about the present.
Well, Carrier moved. He got kicked out of the seminary in Quebec, so he moved to seminary in New Brunswick. He went to the University of St. Louis in Edmundston, New Brunswick. So this is now St. Louis or St. Louis College at the University of Moncton.
Okay.
That's what it is now. So Carrier found this, quote, a breath of fresh air. So I'm assuming that there wasn't the same kind of censorship there. In 1956, he was 19. He published his first book of poetry, Les Jeux Incompris, The Misunderstood Games. He graduated in 1957. And he moved to the University of Montreal, where he completed a master's in French literature in 1959. He wrote his thesis about the poetry of Apollinaire. So Carrier returned to New Brunswick, to St. Louis University, to teach for 2 years. He published another book of poetry. He wrote for magazines and newspapers. So he's coming out as a writer. And he also wrote for and performed sometimes on the Radio-Canada station in Moncton, so the French language CBC there. With a scholarship from the Canada Council for the Arts, I don't believe they give scholarships of this sort anymore, but it was also a bursary from the French government. Carrier, he attended the Sorbonne in Paris.
Okay.
He did, yeah. And he completed a doctoral thesis in French literature in 1961. While he was in Paris, he wrote for Chatelaine magazine, Le Devoir newspaper. He returned to Quebec in 1964. He taught at the University of Montreal, teaching literature, and then at the Military College in Saint-Jean, Quebec. That's a place where he would spend much of his career teaching. So he published his first book of fiction, a collection of fantastical tales called Joli d'œil. So excuse my pronunciation. Pretty Morning. Morning, you know, as in...
like Mourning Someone's Death?
Mourning Someone's Death, exactly. So it's a collection of fantastical tales. It won the prize for the best book in Quebec in 1964.
Oh.
So in 1968, he published perhaps his best-known novel. We've mentioned it already, La Guerre. Yes, sir. It's a surrealist fable of life in a Quebec village during the Second World War. It examines the themes of rural life, religion, the relationship with English Canada. And this was also later adapted to the stage. And I think he got noticed, especially for this book, right?
It's his most well-known work.
Yeah?
Yes.
Still?
Yeah, it is. Still, well, he's a known writer, but he's not as famous or as important as many others of his generation. So La Guerre, Yes, Sir really stands out. And of course, the sweater is, you know, it's on the $5 bill, so you can
pretty famous.
You can get any bigger than that.
That's right. Now, I don't know if you would know this, Max. In 1971, Carrier wrote the script for a movie called The Christmas Martian. You know this?
Yeah. I know about that. Le Martien de Noël.
So this was the first children's feature film made in Quebec. It looks pretty cool. Like I watched a bit of it on YouTube, and it's just wild. It's like really.
You've seen it. It sounds like Max. Oh, you haven't.
No,
okay.
I haven't. No.
It's funny just looking at YouTube comments on things like this too, because somebody who's like from England would be like, yeah, it's like, this was on TV. This was on like BBC station in like 1977. And I remember watching it. And it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. Stuff like that. So some people remember The Christmas Martian. Now, that was the beginning of Cartier's writing for children, which would go on to include a dozen titles. And this, of course, includes The Hockey Sweater. But we'll put that aside for the moment while we just finish up Cartier's biography here. Many of his writings have been performed and adapted to the stage. So in 1971, he became head of the Théâtre du Nouveau Monde, the New World Theater in Montreal, and he held the post for 2 years. So he's like an administrator. Like, you know, he's a guy who ends up being in charge of many of these institutions. So he returned to teaching at the military college in Saint-Jean. And over the years, he occupied several posts, including dean and rector. He still had a job there in 1994 when the college was closed. In 91, Cartier became an officer of the Order of Canada. That year, he also became the head of the Canada Council for the Arts. The job he held
powerful.
For 4 years. A powerful man. This is a man very powerful in federal institutions. In 98, he stepped down from the Canada Council to run for political office. So he was a candidate for the Liberal Party of Quebec in the 1998 provincial election. Cartier lost by 309 votes. Very few votes he lost by. To the Parti Québécois candidate Manon Blanchet in the Montreal riding of Cremazie. So he just barely lost. Now the PQ won that election handily in seat count, although in proportion of the vote, they only won by 0.3%. So they won by like 30 or 40 seats, but barely won in the popular vote. I guess that was the end of his overtly political ambitions. From 99 to 2004, Cartier was the head of the National Library of Canada. In 2005, he appeared on Canada Reads. So Volkswagen Blues was the book that Roch Cartier defended in 2005.
Oh, the classic road novel. That's Volkswagen Blues. Yeah, that's a classic. It tells a story of a guy that travels around the United States in his Volkswagen van, Westphalia. He's on the road and he's following the French Canadian tradition in the United States, because so many French, like a million French Canadians from 1840 to the Great Depression, like on the span of 100 years, emigrated to the United States. So there were many French Canadian, they called that Little Canadas, little towns all over the New England. And that guy goes around in his Westphalia looking for the remnants of the French Canadian traditions.
Sounds like a fun book.
Wasn't Jack Kerouac from a family of French Canadian Americans?
Yeah. Sure. Jack Kerouac's parents are from Le Bas du Fleuve, so they spoke French. Jack Kerouac's first books that he did not publish were written in French.
Oh, I didn't realize he was that francophone. Yeah. Okay. Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. He spoke French with his mother, and that's probably why his writing and his English is so different, and it made him, stand out, because he thought in French, he dreamed in French, and he wrote with a new beat.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
He's a beats beatnik.
Yeah, he is certainly a beatnik.
Cartier is now 85 years old. He still writes and publishes. He's written over 30 books in many genres. He's received a half a dozen honorary doctorates. He has two elementary schools named after him. His lines from The Hockey Sweater appear on the $5 bill, like we've mentioned here. This was the line on the bill appeared on the bill from 2001 to 2013. Quote, "The winters of my childhood were long, long seasons. We lived in three places, the school, the church, and the skating rink. but our real life was on the skating rink.
That's the first line of the novel, of the book.
Of the story. In 2009, Canadian astronaut Robert Thirsk brought a copy of the hockey sweater to the International Space Station for all the aliens to read in the future.
It was for the Christmas Martian to read.
Like this is not, this could not be a more institutionally successful writer or story. Cartier says of the hockey sweater, there is almost not one day in my life that there is not something nice that happens to me because of the story. Although he admits he would like to be noticed for his other 30 books as well. You can't really complain. Come on.
Well, so yeah, it's just like Phil Collins, who's an amazing drummer, but all he's remembered for is this stupid drum fill in the air tonight. And he says, to my demise, I did that once in the studio. Every other time I did something else because I improvise all the time. But I'm known for that
poor
drum
Phil
fill,
Collins.
You know, so... That goes for Roque Carrié and his sweater. He wrote that in 10 minutes on the, the table kitchen. Just a short, very short fable.
I mean, it's hard. You can hardly even call it a short story. It's just like a, it is like a tale.
An anecdote.
It's
almost,
an anecdote almost, but it does have a very clear structure. And everything, but in, like you mentioned, it was written very quickly. So in 1978, Carrié was commissioned by CBC Radio, English radio, to write and perform a piece explaining, quote, what Quebec wants. So this is in
so
the...
So CBC's like, what do you want
what
anyway?
Is going on?
Just tell us.
And indeed, there's good reason for English Canadians to wonder, because this is in the midst of the first Parti Québécois government, elected in 1976. So René Lévesque is the premier. Mm-hmm. And this is leading up to the first referendum on Quebec sovereignty in 1980. So this is in the midst of that whole political tumult that he's asked to explain to the English Canada, like, what does Quebec want?
What do you want?
So Cartier tried to write an essay, but it wasn't very good by his own admission. But he was under pressure to deliver something. So Cartier called upon his childhood memories and very, very quickly wrote The Hockey Sweater. He says, quote, I went back to my table and I started to think, when was it that I felt that I was little me, little Rock, not my mother's son, not my father's son, not my brother's brother. When was it that I felt I was really myself? Unquote. So he says he first felt himself when he was 10 years old playing hockey. He, now this is, it is kind of, it is like really important that this was conceived for an English audience, right? I mean, Cartier says here too, quote, I read this story in English on the national airwaves. To my great surprise, reactions were extremely positive, even though the Maple Leafs sort of occupied the role of the bad guys. Response was so positive, it gave me the idea to publish the story. So the story was then published in French in 1979 under the title, as we've mentioned before, An Abominable Maple Leaf on the Ice. It is like anti, it's much more anti-Maple Leaf, that title. And in 1979, the story also appeared in English translation, we've already mentioned, by Sheila Fishman. But that was when it took the name The Hockey Sweater.
Okay.
It was published under The Hockey Sweater. In this English translation in 79. In 1980, the story was adapted into the animated short film, The Sweater, and it was illustrated, as I mentioned before, by Sheldon Cohen. Now, just so we don't leave Sheldon Cohen out of this, because obviously the animation,
the
illustrations are just really wonderful.
Yeah.
And so...
Yeah, and I think he's one of the biggest reasons why this story is so popular.
So just a little bit about Sheldon Cohen. So he's a Montreal artist, animator, filmmaker. Now, Cohen did not speak French. And he could not skate.
Mm-hmm.
So preparing to produce the film, Cohen visited Saint-Justine with Cartier, and he took photos and he made sketches. And just another little tidbit here. In 1991, Cohen and Cartier teamed up again to make a sequel to The Hockey Sweater. Oh. It was called The Boxing Champion. And this is an illustrated children's story about summertime pursuits in Saint-Justine. So when the ice melts, young Rock laces on the boxing gloves.
Okay.
Yeah, and he gets knocked out.
Go?
He gets knocked out in his first fight.
But I mean, how did the book go?
I think it went okay. I don't know, but it didn't end. I'm surprised they didn't make another NFB short about it, but they didn't.
Okay.
Yeah. Naomi, you want to take over the second half here? So you want to lead us through the kind of the events of the film?
So as we talked about already, in the book and the movie start a bit differently in the sense that the book starts with that line that's on the $5 bill, mm-hmm. Where he talks about how in his village, as a child, they lived in three places, the school, the church, and the skating rink, but their real life was on the skating rink.
Right.
And we already talked about the difference in the film, how they talk about that they have two required locations, the school and the church, but they also play hockey. And he talks about how real battles, I mean, I'm almost reading this up word for word because it, like the, summarizing it would take as long as reading it.
It is
you.
A summary already, but, in a way.
But he talks about how basically their real lives play out in the skating rink. And even when they're in school and church, they're thinking about hockey, basically.
Yeah, that really does resonate for me because yeah. I remember being a kid around that age and just like yearning to get outside to mm-hmm. whatever, play soccer usually or basketball or something. Mm-hmm. And just thinking that the rest of this was bullshit.
Yeah.
I just can't wait to get outside and play sports.
And he says even when they're in church, they're praying about hockey. So like their prayers are like consist of wanting to play as well as Maurice Michel, who's...
You know, praying for that. That's yeah. somebody who, yeah, okay. He really was pious then, too. Like, he actually, because when I had to go to church, I didn't pray. I just waited for it to be over.
Oh, yeah. That's an that's a notable difference in yeah. attitude. and so then he talks about the winter of 1946 when the action of the story takes place mm-hmm. and how he and his friends all wore the same uniform as Maurice Richard. So the red, white, and blue hockey sweater, of course.
Yeah.
But not only that, they all combed their hair and they glued it into place, as he puts it. A very...
Brill cream? In the animation, they all go into the same little container and they're all like grabbing the brill cream
and putting it in.
That's pretty cool.
And they lace their skates like Maurice and they tape their sticks like he did. They cut his picture of the newspapers and they studied him and they knew everything about him.
This is so cute. The animated film is so cute showing them do this because the kids are all different shapes and sizes, but they're all wearing the same jersey and they're all doing...
And they all move. Yeah. They all move in synchronicity. When they glue their hair and they when
together,
they take their
yeah.
sticks, they do it at
right.
the same time.
Yeah, and they all wear the number 9 on their back.
Yeah.
And it shows them playing in the film. They're all like there's two teams and they're all wearing the same jersey.
Yeah.
On both teams.
Yeah, can you differentiate?
Yeah, you just have to try to remember team, who's on your team.
I love that scene, and I love that scene when they're on the when they are they're out playing, and every time they get the puck and make a move, the animation transforms the child temporarily into Maurice Richard. It's beautiful. It is really beautiful.
He like grows and he becomes
suddenly the child grows 2 feet and can suddenly do something special on the ice, and it's really very nice.
Yeah, I felt the same when I was young and I was playing not real hockey on skates, but
street hockey,
outside hockey with my friends, and street hockey in the back alleys, you know. And I was the goalie. I was a goaltender because I wasn't any good. I was good. wasn't good enough to play.
Max, I would do the same. I would be the goalie in street hockey.
To be the goalie. Yeah, I was the goalie, but I had my equipment, and I really felt like Patrick Roy.
Yeah,
that's what happens in your mind when you're playing. You look up to your idols, and you think
Max. I was pretending to be Patrick like Roy as well.
So, you did. Oh,
so,
nice.
I wonder which one of us was the real Patrick Roy.
Well, I can't pretend that I was invested in hockey, but I was forced to play hockey in school, and I was also either defense or goalie.
Yeah, and you see this. You see this this hierarchy in the story. Because when he arrives at the rink with his Maple Leaf sweater,
yes,
he's demoted. He's demoted to the second line and then to defenseman. So he's down in the whilst you need good defensemen in a team to win. So.
Not as much glory I mean, to be won as a defenseman.
You know, I just want to interject, like, you can edit this out if you want to, but the reason that I was put there is because I literally didn't understand the rules of, like, what I was supposed to do. I had trouble remembering who was on my team. I was a bad skater.
Yeah. Just try to prevent the puck to get in the net. That's all you have to do.
Yeah. It's hard to misunderstand that. You know your role. Or like send it that way.
That's what good defensemen do.
But like my high school is right on the canal in Ottawa, so we did play on the canal, so we were on ice. So actually being able to skate was also a requirement.
Right. You could skate.
Yeah, kind of. But I did have figure skates, not hockey skates. It didn't really matter that much. But
because
I just stood there like hoping the puck didn't come towards me.
They could have just put a box maybe like in the middle.
And I could have just like read a book on the bench.
Sat there. Yeah.
I would have preferred that. Anyway, so the book now skips right to the action, but there's more kind of in the movie where we see the family listening to the radio, listening to the hockey game, and the Canadians win, and the little boy goes completely crazy, dances around the house, and goes and jumps on his bed and shakes the ceiling, and all the stuff on the table is rattling, and dust is falling from the ceiling into the teapot.
Yeah, it's a neat establishing sequence. So they show the title, the sweater, and then they have an establishing sequence showing different scenes from the village. Mm-hmm. So I think they visit the cafe, the diner, and they visit. It's somebody's house where a man and a woman are making out on a couch, and it's, they stop. You just kind of see a shadow, a little bit of their movement behind a couch, and you think, and you're like, oh, but it is a kid's film, yeah, so they don't show anything. But he stopped. The man stops and gets up and he turn up the radio because the game's
they're
on
all
and life's
to
gonna.
The game.
Yeah, and the woman is disappointed.
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a very male world of hockey, as we're about to learn, because. All the men in the story are very, very excited and invested. But of course, all the hockey players, everyone playing hockey is a boy. And the mother comes into play and she does not understand at all. This is like a parents do not understand type situation.
Very much a parents don't understand. Yeah.
So little Ruck, unfortunately, that fateful winter, he grows out of his sweater. And it's ripped and it's too small. And the mother says, no more wearing that sweater because we're going to look poor.
Yeah, people are going to think we're poor. So that does speak to the sort of the class position of the mom and her, you know, the family.
Oh, sure.
And then worrying about putting on seeming proper.
Yeah. I would not have been allowed to wear that sweater either for the same reason.
Yeah.
So we want to get you a good sweater. And she doesn't just buy the clothes anywhere. She only buys the latest styles from the Eaton's catalog. Nothing from the general store in town.
I have a note about the Eaton's catalog from Carrier himself. He said, quote, "There was the Eaton's catalog. They were the best based on the feeling, the culture in my family. There was nothing like Eaton's." Mm-hmm. And there was a hierarchy of the catalogs that you ordered from. Now, in the story or in the film, the narrator points out that the mom would not buy stuff from the local store.
Yeah.
Because that's the stuff everyone else gets.
Yeah.
Order from Eaton's, it's like a step above. Now, is it because it's better quality or is it just because other people don't have it?
Yeah, it's from elsewhere.
I'm not sure exactly what it is, but I mean, Carrier says that in his house, it was Eaton's number one. The second tier was Simpsons, the Simpsons catalog, later Simpsons Sears. Mm-hmm. And then third was a French catalog, Dupuis.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. Yeah. Well, I did wonder, and there's an unanswered question that this story invites, which is, did the general store have Canadians' sweaters?
Right. What would the difference be? I mean, maybe difference in quality, fit.
Maybe.
Probably would be.
Maybe.
They must. I mean, every kid in this village has one.
Yeah, it seems like they're pretty easy to come by. But the mother's like, we're getting yours from the Eaton's catalog. But
maybe they're sold out.
No, because she would never buy it there. This is what we learned.
Yeah.
But there is a problem with the catalog because it's in English.
Yeah.
And his mother doesn't speak English. So when she wants something from the Eaton's catalog, she takes out her writing pad and she writes a letter in French to Monsieur Eaton.
Yeah.
The purported owner and I understood that was that Monsieur Eaton was an imaginary character the mother's making.
Certainly her relationship to Monsieur Eaton is imaginary.
Yes, where he personally receives her letters and fulfills her orders, which in this case there's some kind of misunderstanding between some kind of problem with translation, let's say. And the hockey sweater arrives in the mail.
Yeah.
And what is it? But the blue Toronto Maple Leafs hockey sweater.
It's a terrible, terrible Maple Leafs sweater.
Mm-hmm. Abominable.
So, abominable.
But does the mother understand? No, she doesn't.
Yeah.
She's like, it's a sweater. Just wear the sweater.
What's the problem?
What's the problem? She says it's a nice sweater. And she says that Monsieur Eaton is from Toronto and he's probably a Maple Leafs fan and he's going to be offended if they ask, they say they don't want it. And
right.
So they can't.
So Little Rock recoils in horror.
Yes, he does. He cries.
And he's like, don't get away from me with that shirt. And the mom is cajoled, but the mom is perfectly fine. She doesn't even understand the difference between Maple Leafs and the Canadians, really. Like, why that would matter.
How could she not know living in this film?
Well, it's just not. She doesn't understand how important the difference is.
She does not understand one bit.
But also, what she likes is that, it's a new sweater. It fits well.
Yeah.
And it's funny, when Rock is, like, rejecting it, she says this. If you make your mind up before trying, you will not go very far in this life.
That's right.
Which is, like, so, okay. Then Rock says, Maurice would never wear that. And Mom says, you're not Maurice Richard. Then, this is very interesting. The mom says, still trying to convince him to wear this dang shirt, this dang sweater, quote, it's not what you put on your back that counts, it's what you put inside your head.
Again, I think of the Fresh Prince song, the classic, Parents Just Don't Understand.
Parents Don't Understand.
Where his mom says, you go to school to learn, not for a fashion show.
Right, but of course, the mother is being entirely hypocritical here, because indeed, she's very much worried about what's on his back. That's the whole reason he got a new shirt is because she was worried about his appearance. And
yeah,
not
but she doesn't
poor.
Understand why it matters, yeah, which sweater it is. And she points out that, you know, if you don't wear the sweater, you can't play hockey. So, like, that's what's important to you, right? Because Monsieur Eaton is going to be so offended by the request to trade sweaters that it's going to take him, like, a year to do it.
Yeah. What do you think of the mother character, Max?
This is a complicated character, and it's really interesting what it says about... Yeah. The society at that moment, because I mean, there are only 1,000 citizens in that little town. Everybody knows who is poor and who is not poor already. You don't need to have different clothes to perform your class. Everybody knows everyone. So she wants to buy from Eaton for the appearance. And it's weird that she would write to
she's
Mr.
so
Eaton,
naive
with such familiarity as she would have with the general store manager right across the street. I mean, she would know that it's a very important person, a very important company, and there are differences in the French and the English versions that are really interesting, because it says when they're arguing, little Rock is arguing with his mother, and she says to him in French, you know, Mr. Eaton is English, so he would be offended if we rode back to switch the jerseys. And in the English version, she says, you know, Mr. Eaton understands French perfectly, but he's English and he prefers the Maple Leafs. So these differences in the story, this is the most important difference between.
So she's saying this is no misunderstanding. He knew what I wanted, but he didn't want me to have it.
Yeah.
Yes. So, I mean, I don't, this is not a nice character to me in terms of representing the typical French Canadian mother. She's not very understanding of everything that's going on. She doesn't understand his son. She has no idea, and she sounds just stupid,
clueless.
I think,
yeah.
In my opinion.
One thing I find interesting about her is how that detail about how she imagines that shopping from Eaton's creates a personal relationship to Monsieur Eaton, and how that is a kind of class pretension, a desire to only do business with the best and to only consort with like the rich and the wealthy, and how that kind of betrays her desire to be better than other people in the village, right?
Yeah.
But there's always room for misunderstanding because the Canadian, Canadians is the name of the team, but it's also the name of the people living in Canada, and it's also a Canadian identity. So you could be English Canadian, French Canadian. So if you order a Canadian hockey sweater,
it could be from the other Canadian
team, from Ontario.
Yeah.
So there's place for misunderstanding.
I think for her, it's more important to appear well put together and wealthy than to appear like a fan of the Montreal Canadiens. For her, like, that's her hierarchy of importance.
Yeah, but I agree with Max that it's like it's a kind of stupidity that could let her think that that was more important in this context.
Yeah, sure. Sure. You know? Yeah.
Like, it's a profound misunderstanding.
It is a profound misunderstanding, yeah.
So in the movie, she chases him down, forces the sweater onto his body.
She puts it on him.
Yeah, and he's crying, and he's not happy, and he's humiliated.
I mean, he looks good, actually, in the sweater.
Well, it's a nice color, but it's really not the point, is it?
Well, it fits so nicely.
So we already talked about her explanation of how he has to wear it because otherwise he can't play hockey at all for the rest of the season. So off he goes, and you can just imagine how awful he feels heading for the rink in that blue sweater. Anyone who's ever been a child, they're just like cringing.
Yeah.
So off he goes, and everyone's standing there in their red and blue sweaters and the 9 on the back, and he arrives, and the sweater weighs on his shoulders like a mountain, he says. The captain comes and tells him that he needs to wait. He'll need me later on defense. So he's not even playing at first in the book. He's just, benched.
He's benched.
He's benched, man.
Rough.
And by the way, the referee, as we learn from the imagery, is also the priest from the church.
The referee is, yes.
Yeah, the curate. The priest, whatever he is. He's also the hockey coach, or not coach, but referee. So by the third period, he still hasn't played. It's not just that he's on defense or goalie. He has not played at all. He's just sitting there. He's really upset. Finally, someone else gets hit on the nose and gets a nosebleed. And he's like, yes, finally me. He jumps on the ice. And the referee says no. And he says there's already 5 players on the ice. And
so he got called for a penalty.
He gets called for a
penalty. All right. So is this a legitimate penalty or is this persecution?
Yeah, I didn't understand that either. He yells, "This is persecution!"
Right, and he yells and he smashes
the
stick.
He smashes the stick against the ice. It breaks.
Right.
So yeah, is he right? Was this a legitimate penalty?
Yeah, you can't have that's called a too many
it is a
man
real penalty.
Too many men
so
on the ice.
It's because the guy with the nosebleed hadn't actually left the ice yet.
It is.
He was just bleeding on the ice.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, I guess this is a pretty serious game if you're calling penalties of that type.
Or it was just an excuse to get rid of him. I think it was just an excuse to get rid of him.
I think there's room for interpretation here.
I assume that it was just an excuse to get him off the ice.
Well, Rock reads it that way.
Yeah.
He understands that he's being persecuted. He thinks that this is an unfair
penalty.
He is
being persecuted.
Technically, it's a penalty. It is technically a penalty. Would they call it in other circumstances? I don't know.
We'll never know.
Certainly backyard hockey, or nobody ever would call such a penalty. It really is a very technical penalty.
All right. Well, I think we know what's really happening here.
Well, we know that know that the priest is a Canadiens fan because at the beginning of the movie, he listens to the radio broadcast. So he knows the rules. He knows the players, their names and all.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So the priest gets mad and he says, son, this is a difference too in the translation, I think, in the English and the French.
In the English book, he says, "My child, just because you're wearing a new Toronto Maple Leaf sweater doesn't mean you're going to make the laws around here." A good boy never loses his temper. Take off your skates and go to the church and ask God to forgive you.
That's right. So in the original French, if I understood it correctly, he says the vicar says, "My child, just because you have a new Maple Leafs jersey, differently than others, au contraire des autres, that you're going to make the law for us.
They cut it in the English version.
But he really points out that because you're different than everybody else.
Oh, okay.
This is one thing he does not appreciate, right?
Right.
Yeah, and so that's a different value than his mother expressed. Because his mother's expressed the idea that, indeed, he should stand above the others.
He should stand out as being better.
As having nicer clothes.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah, that's
exactly.
Right.
Yeah, as
and
being richer.
But the clergyman it disapproves for another reason, right? Actually, in that documentary from 1972, Carrier talking about his grandfather who ran an unproductive farm for decades. And Carrier in his voiceover says, "Why did my grandfather persist in farming here all these decades, even though it never was successful? The ground, it was infertile."
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "I think it was because of the church.
Mm.
The church tells you to accept your lot in life, what God has given you, and even if you have to suffer."
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So he understands. So Carrier has a kind of certainly a criticism of how the church and its ideology will hold you down, will hold you back, will be a conservative force in your life because it resists you doing anything new or different.
Right. So
we see that here. Yeah.
Yeah, and right at the beginning, it says the first few sentences of the text shows that even if we're all the same, we still can have rivalries. There's a hierarchy going on.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Right inside the communities within ourselves. That's what it says. The first sentences, that's what it real life was on the skating rink. La vraie vie était sur la patinoire. Les vrais combats se gagnaient sur la patinoire. La vraie force apparaissait sur la patinoire. Les vrais chefs se manifestaient sur la patinoire. So all the life struggles, you would experience them on the skating rink without even having this external rivalry with another team, another country, for that matter. You would still have a complete society, functioning society within your own community. So this is a really important trope in Quebec literature. Obviously, he's writing that at the almost in the 80s, in the 70s, at the end of the 70s. But the end of the terroir novel.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Terroir would be writing the rural novel, talking about church, family values, agriculture, the French language as being the most important foundations of the society. The last important rural novel is called The Survenant, somebody who's appearing in the village. He's from somewhere else, and he disrupts the community because he's from somewhere else. So that exotic detail coming in and disrupting the equilibrium is always something that it's a recurring theme.
Right. Yeah, it happens here with the
Quebec
with
literature.
The shirt.
So that's interesting.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. The shirt that arrives from outside.
Exactly.
Exactly. That's so true.
It's really interesting, and it's clearly a political fable. Very interesting in many regards, especially when the mother says, you have to respect the power of Mr. Eaton. You have to respect that if you want to be a good boy, that's a nice lesson from the story. If you want to be a good French-Canadian boy, you have to respect the power of the English people who, have the control of what we can wear in life, of what all the goods we can have to grow in the society, move up classes. You have to respect them. That's a nice. That's why I think when Carrier presented that story first, it was well received in English Canada, because it shows a side of Quebec that
I guess
the English Canada might like. We're kind of a little bit, we're religious. Yeah. We don't accept the others. It's all cliches that are summed up in that little story. And that's why it fits so well, the narrative about French Canada.
Mm.
So I'm not surprised at all. It's on the $5 bills. It's really it's a vision of Quebec that fits yeah. well what Canada wants to know
right.
about.
I mean,
Quebec,
it's a nostalgic
how it's represented.
Revisitation, right, of a pre-quiet revolution Quebec.
Yeah. It's so there's two pages left.
Oh, yeah,
story,
go ahead, please.
So maybe
continue.
I'll just tell you how it ends.
Yeah, we'll just finish the story. And
so
then
I'll just read
more.
You the rest. So wearing my maple leaf sweater, I went to the church where I prayed to God. I asked God to send me right away 100 million moths that would eat up my Toronto maple leaf sweater. The end.
Right. Mm-hmm. And in the animated film, there's a wonderful kind of, what would you call it, a thought bubble? Where Maurice Richard appears, and he reaches out and doesn't he shake Little Rock's hand? Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, he shakes his hand. Yeah,
that's right.
So actually, he was praying to Richard. He wasn't praying God. He was praying to Richard.
We get to see
and
the cloud
another,
of moths.
They did. They
in
did.
His imagination.
There is an animated moths arriving.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, well, so many little details that were added in the movie that are not in the book. That's really interesting. Yeah. The movie is so much richer, and it shows little scenes, interesting scenes, like when the little boy steals a cookie in the jar when his mother is, you know, she's talking about something else, and he steals a cookie.
Right.
The couple kissing at the beginning when they're listening to the hockey game. That's a really nice added detail. And the priest listening to the hockey game too, which shows, I mean, it's a rural little community in the 40s, but you can see modernity appearing there too.
The radio.
The fact that the priest is the referee. Yeah, that's an important detail because at that moment, it was religious teaching. The schools were led by religious people, and they would teach everything.
Yeah,
sports. They would skate with the younger ones. They would go hiking and hunting and everything. They taught science. They taught everything that would make these young boys in the 40s become the leaders of the Quiet Revolution one generation later. So the priests, of course, were a conservative force, keeping all in place and preventing, you know, liberal ideas and modern ideas. But many priests quit the church at the Quiet Revolution. And all these young people, Roch Carrier and himself, went to the seminary.
So people like Carrier a generation earlier would have gone into the church in some capacity, because he was an administrator and an educator, and to access those roles, you needed to be in the church, right?
Sure. And most of them would reject the church once they became adults, and the society changed so much. And to see that priest, of course, he wants to teach a lesson. You have to accept defeat. Yeah. You don't, you know, keep your tempers down and everything. But still, he's promoting sports and health and every. So these priests were good teachers and helped the younger generation to become adults that would participate in the Quiet Revolution. So that's an interesting generation at that exact moment in the 40s. To be a kid in the 40s, you would grow into modernity, and priests would participate in the transformation of the society. So that's an interesting character, the priest, because you know he loves hockey. He listens to the radio, and he's the referee. But that's still, he has to perform his duty and punish that young man. But which is interesting, because when the church in Quebec disappeared as a very powerful institution, Quebec has been since searching for another transcendence, and hockey has fulfilled some kind of this function, because the Canadians were so powerful, the team, they won so many championships, and French Canadian players were so good, so you could put your hope into their victory. You could hope for Canadians' victory, and sometimes we refer to the Canadians as a religion. That's what fanatism is, just like some football teams in Europe or in South America. You know, there's the community, you know, feel like they're represented in their team and the hope. And I mean, that, and that's a good reason why Maurice Richard appears in church when Carrier is praying.
That's right.
He's like a religious figure. And we have that, well, less today because the team is not as important anymore and doesn't really represent French Canada as it used to. So we don't feel that religious appeal with the Canadians today, but it has been some kind of a religion.
I mean, Rock was like, in that final scene, what has he learned? He's been ostracized. I mean, maybe just temporarily in the story, but he's been ostracized from his community. And that is supposed to build character, strength in him, that he can take that. He can take that punishment and deal with it. And he also wants to get rid of the Maple Leafs jersey. He still does, despite his mother's insistence. He would just like this Maple Leaf jersey to disappear.
Oh, his mother's just wrong. We all know that.
Well, I feel like in a way the mother signaled insisting on Rock being an individual, appearing better than everyone else. There's a little hint of the value, that kind of liberal value of being a strong individual who stands above the rest, that Rock actually absorbs from her. Like, I think, despite the story, I think in a way, like, you kind of see Rock having emerged from this whole thing as more of an individual, I think. Like, resisting his mother in some ways, saying, no, I don't want this jersey, but also adopting a little bit of her lesson in that you have to be better than other people, just a little bit. And also having been kicked out from the game and all of his friends and all left behind, and he's been ostracized from the community. It's kind of a signal to the writer, the budding writer, who we know already is a successful writer because he's written this story and he's now famous, that you're going to have to leave the village. You're going to have to reject or grow beyond some of the values and the people and the ways of life that you found here, right? It's kind of set him up to, the story sets him up to leave in a way.
Yeah, I was really left. I'm really left wondering at the end of that story, but I want to know what happens. Does he get to play again or what? Does he get a new Canadian sweater or does he get accepted with his blue sweater? What happens?
There's a famous photo. There's a famous photograph of 10-year-old Rock Carrier wearing the maple sweater.
It?
And he's smiling. He's got a big smile. Yeah, there is a famous photo out there as proof.
Oh, is
you know,
right?
This really, the story really happened.
Okay. Oh my gosh, that's so cute.
Yeah. So I guess we've already made some summary remarks on the story. Any other closing remarks, final thoughts from you, Naomi, or you, Max?
Well, just for us, you know, a very simple appreciation. I think that the movie
way better,
way better than the story itself. Add all the power of the imagery to this very short story adds to it a great deal because, you know, showing
so much texture
without telling adds so much more to the narrative intent, that all the little details we notice, that eating a cookie in the jar, the family eating, drink, you know, listening to the hockey game while eating at the table, all the little details, it makes it way better. And I think that's one of the biggest reasons why it was such a success, because of the quality of the drawings and the movie. Because it's a little insignificant, this little short story, but what it grows into with the drawings, it makes it way better. And it adds signification, because that appearance at the end, the Maurice Richard appearing in the church. It adds a lot of signification, and you can find so much more information with the movie than just with the text. So it, you know, sometimes we say that cinematographic adaptations of novels are not good. They don't give more, they give less. But in that particular instance, it's the contrary. Oh, and the music too. Yeah. We didn't talk about the music in the movie, but
we did it.
Yeah. So at the end, when he's praying and Maurice Richard appears, the song that's playing is the song of the Canadien Montréal that we hear on the organ in the Montreal Forum.
On the church organ.
Oh, that's so good.
And the arrangement turns it into religious ending with a suspended fourth that resolves into the first chord. So they turned the Canadian song into a religious anthem. So that's significance so for you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks for catching that detail.
Yeah, yeah.
I totally missed that. I was wondering, I mean, so this story emerges, it's like Carrier writes it in the context of like Quebec, you know, growing Quebec sovereignty movement. And he wrote it in direct response to that. I mean, he was asked to, right, by the CBC. How do you read the politics of this story in the, I guess, in the frame of federalism or sovereignty? Or, I mean, I'm assuming that Carrier was very much a federalist, considering he made his life and career in federal institutions.
Sure, sure was, of course.
Yeah.
Well, it's...
I mean, I read this as a defense of federalism. It must be, in a way.
Of course. Yeah. Well, you have to accept that Eaton's in a position of power, and he gives us modernity. He sends us what to wear and gives us a better life. So you have to respect that. And it's not a problem to have different ideas and different people and symbolism coming into our community that will be okay. I mean, it's hard not to read it as a political stance saying, all right, we're Canadians in blue or red, and that's what happens, and we have to accept it and work around it. And it also pinpoints some kind of paints a negative portrait of Quebec French Canadian rural life. The priest will punish you. Don't try to be different. So there's some kind of self criticism from Carrier about French Canada. So it's definitely a political piece of art, of course. But there's so many different, you know, comparing the two versions also highlights important differences, because they were all accepted by Carrier because he was the narrator of the French movie and the English movie. So he's okay with every difference between the different versions. Mm-hmm. But to add in the English version that Mr. Eaton speaks very good French, why would you add that? So the English readers would think that Quebecers believe that Eaton speaks French because obviously he does not. The French Canadians in the upper society would speak English to Mr. Eaton. He wouldn't speak French at all. So what is the purpose of this transformation? What is the purpose of removing the abominable in the titles? Yes. Why is it toned down in the English version? These are good political questions. I don't have the answer, but obviously it was made friendlier to the English reader and to the English viewer. All these little differences are really interesting. And also in the drawings, there are
misspellings or mistakes?
Misspellings or? In the French words in the drawings. You said that the artist didn't speak French. Well, it shows because when there are French words in the book, there are misspellings, mistakes.
Like in the illustrations.
In the illustration. Even in the letter that the mother writes, and she's a teacher, and she makes a spelling mistake in French. Cher Monsieur Eaton, there's a misspelling error in her own writing as a teacher.
Okay.
So all these differences also highlight how we work as translators between the two cultures, and how you know, this was not proofread. Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
So Max, at this point of the episode, I'd like to ask our guest what projects they're working on currently or in the future.
Yeah, well, I'm working on my postdoc project was a research creation project, but actually I only did research because there's so much work to do during these last 2 years. But now that I know what I have before me, I'm going to start writing next year about about a fur trader who was injured by a shotgun to the stomach. Actual true story in the 19th century. And his injury healed into a fistula, we called a hole that gave access to his stomach by the outside. And the physician who saved his life was a military surgeon at the trading post in the Great Lakes, saw the opportunity to study the stomach, how the digestion works. So from 18 for in the 1820s, he studied him for 10 years roughly, and proved the chemical process of digestion on his guinea pig, who was a fur trader from Berthierville, a French Canadian, like the majority of the voyageurs.
So I'd heard of this story before.
Yeah, it's like in all these ephemerid little weird stories we hear about. But you know, this physician, he's an American hero. He has universities named after him, and prices and gastroenterology and everything. But his guinea pig is not known. He's a French Canadian, and I'm going to write his life story, biographical novel. So I worked on the research, historical research, the last 2 years, and now I'm starting writing. So I'm hoping for time and money and mental space to dive into that, because it's really a wonderful project. It shows the whole 19th century. It's fascinating. I can't wait for that. And also the translation of my latest novel will come out next year.
Oh, so it will. Great.
Yeah, so pretty interesting things coming up.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, Maxime, thank you so much for talking with us today. It's wonderful to have your perspective on this.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for the invitation. It was fun.
It was great. Thank you so much.
And thank you, everyone out there, for watching and listening. And we'll see you next time.